You're listening to The Osiris Mounir Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey, my luminaries, my looms, my people of light, love, and laughter out there. It's a lot going on. I guess we could all laugh about it, or we could not. Before we get into the show, let me thank our wonderful sponsor, Kevin Pike of Coldwell Banker, Senior Real Estate and Probate Specialist, 818-571-1508. Take all of your real estate issues to him, even the ones that are being set up now. We have no control over it, but take everything to him. He's very, very, very knowledgeable about anything to do with that. Kevin Pike, Coldwell Banker. So let's get into our show. So thank you all. Shout out to those of you who choose love over chaos. Shout out to you. Today, our guest is he's an amazing human being. I have heard about him from his music. I thought I'd never meet him in person, but I'm having the great pleasure of bringing to you a performer, musician, amazing songwriter. And when you hear who he is, you'll know why I say amazing songwriter. He's come all the way from the soulful streets of Brooklyn and the lilac fields of Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco, all the way to the corners and edges of Venice Beach right here in LA. He is a legend among legends, working with the legendary Marty Balin. I am talking about Jess Barish of Jefferson Starship, Jefferson Airplane, whatever you want to call it. It's Jefferson. Okay. Hey, Jesse.
Hello, Osiris.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's what is it, Thursday? Yeah.
Already. It goes by quick.
It's Thursday.
Well, welcome to our show.
I like the lavender streets of the Haight-Ashbury. That's a good one.
The lavender fields.
Well, I like
because
that.
You know what? Couldn't think of a way to associate, because I've done psychedelics. I couldn't think of a way to associate with the experience of psychedelics with Haight-Ashbury, so I was trying to find a way to say it, and so I said
like another way of saying the flower children.
The flower children, that's right. So listen, let's get into it. Okay. I want to go all the way back to your old Haight-Ashbury days, and this is what I want to know. What was the image of rock, and how were rock musicians viewed back in those Haight-Ashbury days?
Well, the musicians were like the Pied Pipers. We were like the, I wasn't really writing songs in the Haight-Ashbury time. I was more of a flute player.
Mm-hmm.
But the musicians, you know, the Grateful Dead, the Quicksilver Messenger Service, they were like the forefront of the revolution. You know, they were, you know, Janis Joplin, Big Brother, Jefferson Airplane. They were all the spokespeople for the hippies, you know, and for that whole psychedelic movement.
Yeah, they did do a lot there. I am going to truthfully say, I did not get introduced to rock until I went into the military. I wasn't around rock. My dad introduced us to classical, jazz. My mom was gospel, R&B. I did not hear, I heard rock, but didn't relate to it until I got into the military and I got around white boys. And the white boys were the ones that had all of the good drugs, all of the good psychedelics. The brothers had the good weed. And I started hanging around them. And that's when I started really listening to rock. I wouldn't have known it outside of that. So I want to ask you, how did rock come to finally gain notoriety so that people like Jefferson Starship, Jefferson Airplane, whatever you want to call them, and Marty Balin were able to make such a stance at that time?
It was just the right place at the right time. You know, it was just the music. The music spoke for the whole movement. It was the most incredible time. As I look back on my life, those years, you know, mainly from 65 to 68, those were the 60s to me, you know. the real heart of them. And there was something happening, and the musicians and the bands and the artists were like leading the charge to the other side of the reality.
They wanted to be heard. They needed to be heard.
Yeah.
Why did they change the name? Why did they change it from Jefferson Airplane to Jefferson Starship? Is there a story behind it?
I think the Jefferson Airplane. I wasn't friends with Marty until the Starship, but the Jefferson Airplane, they broke up, and then Paul Kantner and Gray Slick did an album called Starship in the early 70s, and then Marty had already quit the band, and they brought Marty in, and they named it Jefferson Starship, but it was actually the name of an album.
Okay.
That Grace and Paul did on their own. And then the Jefferson Starship had its own life.
Oh, okay.
You know, when it became a band of the 70s, where the Airplane was the 60s.
Okay. I wonder why. Was it the same band or different elements, the same people, or it broke up and then came back all the way back together?
It was different people. And then over the years, some of the original members came in. Yorma and Jack had their own little splinter group called Hot Tuna.
And, that's cute.
And it was kind of a revolving thing. Marty would stay in the band for a while, then he'd leave and he'd come back. And it was kind of a revolving stage, you know. Mm-hmm. I didn't become friends with Marty till like the early 70s. And then we became really tight and close friends.
Which brings me to my next question. A lot of musicians have a hard time collaborating because their egos are so big they can't like see past a partnership or whatever. What made Marty different that you actually became good friends, like brothers, I'm assuming? And then you wrote and worked together. What was that experience like?
Well, basically, we did not write together. We were friends, and I was a songwriter. I would bring him songs, and he would, yes, and I'm going to learn this one. I'm not going to learn. We rarely wrote together, you know. It was more like I was the writer, and he was the singer.
Okay.
And so we kind of bonded and became really good friends, and that was the beginning of our story together.
Mm-hmm. And when the first song that you wrote with him, was that Hearts?
No, Count On Me.
Count On Me was before Hearts.
Yeah.
Okay, because I thought Hearts was before
Count On Me. I did. I wrote it. And when I wrote it, I felt like, I think this is a commercial song. And I usually didn't say that about my own songs. But when I wrote Count On Me, something said, this is a hit song. So I did a demo of it with a couple of other songs. And Marty took that demo to RCA, because he was with the Starship at that point, mm-hmm. and he knew all the executives at RCA. I think it was Ken Glancy who was president of RCA at the time. Mm-hmm. And Marty got me a deal with RCA as a solo artist.
Mm-hmm.
And while we were recording that, I don't know, I heard that it was Paul Kantner or somebody in the Starship heard Count On Me, and they wanted to do it and they're as part of their next album. And I was, you know, caught in the heart, you know, between should I save it for myself or should I let the Starship do it, you know?
Mm.
And I just figured, you know, there's too many crazy stuff that happens. I'll let the Starship do it because they'll have a hit with it, you know? And that's what happened. I gave my, and I still to this day don't think my version would have been a hit song. Even though it was a hit song, I don't think I had it sonically. The hit version, and the Starship did. So no regrets. You know, my band at the time was mad at me for giving up the Count On Me because they all thought it was a hit. But like I said,
it was a hit.
It was a hit, but I don't think it would have been a hit for me because it didn't have that AM radio sheen,
you
know, that veneer that, you know, which the Starship did have, you know. So I gave it, and then like I said, that was just like I wrote that by myself, and Hearts I wrote by myself, and Hearts didn't happen until about 3 or 4 years later.
I listen to Hearts; it's very pretty.
Thank you.
You sound so innocent in Hearts. It's such a
Which song, which did you listen to? Me playing acoustic guitar?
Yeah, I heard the one you playing acoustic guitar.
Oh,
I
yeah,
like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, that was me.
Very soft. You have a very, I don't know you, you know, as well as some people, but you have a, it's a very soft heart. I felt your heart in hearts.
And yeah, that was the nature of that song, you know. And every time I do a song, I actually take on a different persona, you know. But for that song, and I mean, I'm just waiting for someone to sample it and use it in like a hip hop song.
It's a beautiful, beautiful song.
Thank you so
beautiful
much.
Beautiful song. I was impressed. I'm like, oh wow, it didn't sound anything like I thought it would sound.
Well, did you ever hear Marty's version of it?
I didn't hear his version. I was only focused on you.
Well, you heard my version. You should go back and listen to Marty Ballon Arts on YouTube, and then you'll see
the difference.
The difference, because the one that you saw of me playing, that's the bare bones song.
Minimal.
The way I wrote it, the way I felt it, and then you'll hear what Marty did and his band did with that song. Which I love. I love the Marty's version of it.
Both of them. I haven't heard Marty's version, but I don't think it would be so far away from your version that it would change the song.
Marty's got a different voice. He's got a very special kind of an aching and a yearning in his voice that that is very recognizable. So he did a great job with it, and you know, put me on the map. That was 1980 when that happened.
Yeah, and then back to Count On Me. Count On Me, according to what I read, was used in 2005 in the movie The Family Stone.
Right.
And then again in Adam Sandler's movie in 2010, Grown Ups.
Right.
And that's the same song. So both songs were hits. So why did they pick Count On Me? Well, you said Count On Me was first. Was Hearts out at the time the movie?
Yeah, but Count On Me was more of an uplifting song. Hearts is a little bit of a sad song, you know. You know, it's just the way it is. Count On Me was more of like an anthemic kind of, maybe a better song over the end title thing, you know. I wish someone would use Hearts in a movie, because I think it would be a great song.
It's a beautiful song.
For a romantic, romantic, you know, man finds girl, man loses girl.
I just saw that in Autumn in New York with Richard Gere and Winona Ryder, is about that thing where they meet in New York. He's a much older man. Something happens and she doesn't make it.
Is that a new movie?
No.
Oh.
It's called Autumn in New York. I've had just seen it, and it's an old movie.
Right.
Well, you know, Winona Ryder is in it. She's now doing a whole other thing. So it's an older movie, definitely.
Yeah, but I'm waiting for Hearts to be used in a movie or something.
It would have been a beautiful movie for that kind of song if the music soup had looked at it.
Any music supervisors out there hearing this, use Hearts in your next romantic comedy.
You music soups out there, use Hearts. It's a very romantic song. It touched me. Even with you just singing, it's very pretty and very touching.
Oh, it's funny. A good friend of mine's wife left me a message a couple of days ago. She said, on my phone, she said, Jesse, I was driving home and Hearts came on the radio and I started crying. And it's such a beautiful song. And and she'd never done that before. You know, I'd never really talked to her on the phone. I would talk to him. He was my friend, and he's Terry's, a good friend of Terry's also.
Mm-hmm.
Jay Levy.
Jay.
You know Jay?
I don't know him. I've heard of him.
Yeah, yeah. So she was, and she'd never done that before. She just said, it's such a beautiful song, and thank you so much. And it really touched me, made my day, you know.
My feeling is that somebody is going to get around to that song. It's a beautiful song. The other thing, you are a songwriter.
Right.
In writing songs, what kind of frame of mind, how do you get yourself in the place to write a hit song or to write a song that somebody may interest? What is the process? What does it take you, days to write, hours?
No.
You have to go through heartbreak, breakups. What do you do to impede you or push you to write some kind of intense lyrics. What happens?
You know, it's so many, it happens in so many different ways, but.
That's here.
I just sit down, I'll play some guitar chords. Usually this is my MO for writing songs. I'll play some guitar chords, a melody will come, and then I will put words to that melody. Sometimes I write the lyrics first, you know, like as a poem, and then I write the music to it. I can be in any state of mind. I can be depressed. I can be happy. I can be heartbroken. I can be just falling in love. My state of mind really has nothing to do with it. And I go long periods of time with dry spells where I'm not writing, and then all of a sudden I'll write 5 songs in a week. You know, and some of them may be... commercial. I don't know anymore, you know. I just write whatever comes out, and the powers that be.
Do you write at particular times or early in the morning?
I just write whenever
it hits you,
whenever the spirit moves me, you know.
Okay, that's an artist.
Like the other day I saw a clip of Leonard Cohen with his band singing some called The Future, and it inspired me to write a lyric, and I wrote a lyric and put music to it, and boom, it's a song.
Now, let's go back to Brooklyn.
Okay.
The streets. What made you leave Brooklyn to go to California? Then
some stops along the way, but I was born and raised in Brownsville, which is
Texas?
No, Brownsville, Brooklyn. Brownsville was a neighborhood in Brooklyn.
Oh, okay. When you said Brownsville, yeah. I thought
Brownsville.
Texas.
That's where Mike Tyson's from.
I got Brownsville.
Brooklyn. So okay. I was born and raised in Brooklyn, and then in the 40s and 50s, I mean, Brooklyn was such a colorful place. As I look back on it, it was magical. Of course, when you're a child, everything's magical. But Brooklyn was, was an interracial, Puerto Rican, Black, Jewish, Irish neighborhood, a mixture of all cultures. Mm-hmm. When I was about 9 years old, we left Brooklyn and moved to the Catskill Mountains, which is about 100 miles north of the city, to a little town called Liberty. Where my mother used to live when she was a teenager, and she always wanted to go back to Liberty. So in the mid-50s, 1954, we moved to Liberty, where I lived for about 6 years. And in 1960, my dad suddenly had a brain something or aneurysm, and he passed away at his desk. He was 45.
Cool.
And my mother wanted somehow in the middle of my 10th grade in a town that I'd sort of grown up in, my mother decided she wanted to be near her sister in Miami Beach. So we, in the middle of my sophomore year in high school, we moved to Miami Beach,
mm-hmm.
where I finished high school and graduated in 1963. At that point, we decided to move to California. So I got to California in 1963, drove out to California with my brother-in-law, my sister's husband, and got to California right at the dawn of the magical moment, magical mystery tour, you know?
Mm.
And at that point, I was a jazz guy. I grew up in my high school. I wanted to be a jazz flute player. Jazz was my main love. I wasn't into rock and roll. I wasn't into folk music. I was a jazz guy, you know? And so, you know, the first night in Los Angeles, I saw John Coltrane at Shelley's Manhole. I was reading Downbeat in high school, and I was a beatnik, you know, basically. Mm-hmm. Too young to really be a beatnik, but my first night in Los Angeles, I saw Coltrane in a Thursday night. I'll never forget it. It's like the Holy Grail, you know,
mm-hmm.
the original quartet.
How did you feel about experiencing John Coltrane at such an early age and coming from, you know, another place?
It was a revelation, you know. I mean, the club was empty. It was a Thursday night at Shelley's Manhole, which was like the jazz club in Los Angeles in those days, you know. And I was with a friend who picked me up at the motel I was staying at. I had his number from a mutual friend, and he showed up in his Porsche Speedster, and we're driving around Hollywood. We drive down Cahuenga, and there's John Coltrane. I said, dude, you got to stop and listen to this guy. And he didn't know John Coltrane from John Hancock, you know. But he followed my lead, and we went in, and there was John Coltrane. The place was empty. He was off the bandstand, walking through the crowd, and then the non-crowd, you know, walking through the club, off the stage. And it was a revelation, you know. I mean, this is someone that I'd, you know, listened to and heard about and worshipped. And here I am, you know. Anyway, it was a great moment.
What was it? But at that time, wouldn't he have been? I remember, I don't know, I've never been to Shelley's Manhole, but I remember hearing of it. At that time, wouldn't he have been famous enough that it would have, people would have been in there?
You would have thought so, but for some reason, the club was basically empty. It was a weeknight. Maybe on the weekends, the place filled up, because Coltrane was already a legend at that point, and I was surprised that the club, there were so few people in. And but it was definitely a turning point for me. And you know, soon after this, I would get involved with psychedelics and the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. And,
like,
you know, and smoking weed from morning till night.
You know, I went through all of that.
Yeah, you were a little bit younger.
I'm younger, but I still, when I got into the military, I like I told you. All the white guys were the ones I had never heard of rock or acid or anything. And I'm a little country girl coming out of Texas, never been anywhere without her brothers on her tail. And it was quite an eye-opening experience for me, because it really, I will say that I was very fortunate in that I used things like that to broaden my mind. I never used anything to, because I was depressed. It was all like, wow, I wonder what it's going to do to your mind. What will it do? And then I was heavily into Don Quixote. I was heavily into Timothy Leary. Yeah. People that black folks had never heard of. Here I am, a little black girl. I had no one to relate to.
I think we met in the 60s.
We must have. I had no one to talk to. I was like this kid, but I wanted to step out of a box. And because I got into a lot of friction with other parts of my culture, because I decided to go a different direction completely. I became a Buddhist. I got into metaphysics. I didn't want to do anything that
meant to tell you that one of my oldest friends, a guitar player, ended up playing with Tina Turner for 20 years. And she was a Buddhist.
A Buddhist hardcore, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And he played with her for 20 years. After Ike left, you know. All through the What's Love Got to Do with It and that whole phase of Tina's
career. That whole phase.
Yeah.
And she was going through quite a bit. But what I wanted to go back to that we were talking about, I read, and correct me if I'm wrong, because not everything you can trust, but I thought I read it in your bio, that the song... Count on Me became so famous that it got over a million plays on radio and got the 1 million BMI award. Is that true?
Correct.
Why do you think that is?
You know, it didn't go as high. It got into the top 10, but it didn't go much higher than that.
Oh.
Some songs are like turntable hits. You know, they just get a lot of airplay. And I think Count on Me was one of them. You know, I don't know how many airplays it's had since I got the BMI award, which was, many, many, many years ago. It's up on my wall. You can't see it right now. Let me see. One of those, I'm pointing to it.
Things over there.
There it is. There's my BMI award right there.
I see it up at the top.
Okay.
What do you think, Jesse, what do you feel? That's and think, better. And mostly feel.
Yeah, that's better. I'm a more of a feeler than a thinker.
Yeah, I can tell. That's why I say mostly feel. What do you feel about the direction that not only rock music, but music in general? And I don't mean to bastardize the kid. I don't mind the kids. I don't mind hip hop. I like all of it. But there is a core of music that anyone, no matter what age group, no matter what culture, can relate to. is there that kind of music? Is there that music in rock these days? Where can we find that thing that we used to get off on in music that may or may not be here now?
I don't think it's here anymore. I'm sorry to say. I'm so out of touch with what's happening in the music world right now. I watch the singing shows, you know, like The Voice,
yeah,
and American Idol, just mainly to hear the songs these kids sing. You know, most of them that I haven't heard, but I don't listen to the radio. I don't buy CDs. Nobody listens to CDs anymore. I'm not an iPod guy, you know, so I don't, it's like I said, the only new music I hear is when I watch these singing shows, which I like. I happen to enjoy them. You know, a lot of friends of mine hate them, but I enjoy watching The Voice and American Idol. But I don't know, you know, now with AI and all this crazy stuff that's going on, I'm lost right now, you know. That's why I just stick with my acoustic guitar, pick it up, write a song, sing some old songs. I'm entertaining myself. If something happens, it's not going to be because I was out there hustling anybody, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Trying to get a song in a movie. If it's just something's going to happen, it's going to happen, you know. But I'm really out of touch with what the kids are listening to, or Taylor Swift, or any bands. I'm 80 years old, you know.
That's only 8 years old.
That's what?
That's only 8 years old.
Eight?
That's only age eight. Yeah. If you add numbers, if you're in the numbers.
Oh, then I'm 8 years.
You know.
I mean, I have great grandchildren. I have my grandkids are having kids.
Wow. You know, it must be interesting to have great grandkids. I don't have any. I have one grandchild. That's it. But I would think that in your position with a person coming out of fame and fortune and rock and music, that there is still a thread of hope that you have for the music industry. And if we had to talk about it, what would that be? What would be that hopeful thread? Where can we, you know, where do we go for good music now, unless you're just back from the day and you know good music?
I guess, you know, that's where the live performances come in. I don't really gravitate towards performing that much. I would if I had a great band, I was rehearsed, and I had a reason to go out and perform and promote a product. I would love to have a great band. But, but I guess a lot of these kids go to live shows. You know, they go see the Eagles. They go see the Dead when they were here, with, you know, they go see, I don't know, there's got to be hope for the young kids today. They seem to, they don't know what we know. They didn't ever been through the stuff that we've been through, you know? So I don't really know what young people are, you know. It's weird, because I used to be a young person.
We all did.
Yeah, and I'm still a 20-year-old inside of myself, you know. I look in the mirror and go, who is that guy?
I can tell. It has nothing to do with your age. I try to explain that to people. That's such it's such a nasty way to measure human beings, with age and color.
Well, it's the way society looks at you, you know.
And it's a way to set up disharmony between people. It's disharmonious.
Yeah. So, you know, I just carry on with my life. I do exactly what I did. I live in Venice Beach. I've been in the same apartment 35 years.
Wow.
I'm a half a block from the boardwalk. I walk on the boardwalk every day.
Yeah.
You know, I'm basically doing what I did when I was 20. You know, writing songs, trying to survive, living at the beach, living the good life, you know.
Have you had to change your songs, or have you changed your style of writing or working through songs because of the new kind of music, or is it pretty much the same?
I don't listen to other people's music anymore. I've been influenced as much as I need to be. I just, you know, I write what I feel at the moment, in the moment. So I'm really not concerned with what's happening in the world. I don't listen to anyone else to be inspired, you know.
Mm-hmm. Do you think if Marty were around and you guys were still writing, do you think he would be able, together with you, come up with this song that we did today?
Absolutely. I miss Marty so much, you know.
Yeah.
Because he was getting ready to do a whole album of my songs, Balancing's Barish, and was planning it, and then he got really sick. And it's a long story, but he passed away, you know. And but he was planning on, we had talked about it for years, and he was actually, it narrowed it down to 10 or 15 songs of mine that he wanted to put on a record, and he died before it happened, you know. It broke my heart.
And no one's ever thought to do a tribute to him or anything?
Not, so far, no. You know, I mean, so I miss Marty to this day. I mean, he was my mentor. I mean, you know, in the Summer of Love, 1967, I was listening to the Jefferson Airplane, Surrealistic Pillow was my soundtrack for that summer. That was the summer my son was conceived. It was a magical, magical. I had left the Haight-Ashbury, moved to Northern California. We lived in a big, I call it a commune, but it was people living together. I don't know what you'd call it.
Commune.
But Surrealistic Pillow was my soundtrack. Marty singing, and not knowing that years later Marty would become like my best friend, you know. So it was really kind of wild when I look back, but literally that summer was a psychedelic, crazy summer of love. Mm-hmm. And I always tell my son that he was born in a moment of, in a time of love, you know, 1967. And years later, in the 70s, I ended up living in Mill Valley in Marin County.
Mill Valley? Jeez.
Mill Valley. And that's where I met Marty, you know.
What was Marty doing in Mill Valley?
That's where he lived. When he started making some money with the airplane, he bought a house in Mill Valley.
Oh.
Mill Valley was just right across the Golden Gate Bridge.
That's right,
you know, Sausalito, then Mill Valley, and, you know, it was the little bedroom community of Northern California. And Marty was one of the first people to leave San Francisco and move to the suburbia, which was Mill Valley, but a beautiful town.
And I know, I've been there.
When I got there, it was, you know, I had a friend, and he said, you know, and he was friends with Marty. He said, you know, you should meet Marty. And he brought me to Marty's house, and Marty and I just clicked. And he became my mentor. Magic. He got me a deal with RCA, like I said, produced two albums of mine, that I did two albums for RCA. And, you know, like, he was a huge part of my life.
Yeah, like a brother.
Like a brother.
Do you feel, again, if he were around or if he weren't around, do you feel that there is space for musicians of your time? And I'm looking way broad. I'm not looking at the internet and what the kids are doing. I'm talking about music in general that offers itself to anyone, which is what the internet does. So if you like rock music, internet has rock. For people that like rock, people like R&B, whatever you like, the internet, YouTube, and all of them have it. But do you think that there will ever come a time that things will balance out in the music industry and everything will be offered on radio, on a same station platform, not just, oh yeah, to hear classic rock, you go to the classic rock station. To hear this, you go to this station. Do you think they'll ever come together and just play music just to play music?
You know, that was the great breakthrough of the 60s radio, like KSAN, and you know, it was like a free-form radio. It was like you could hear Ravi Shankar, then the Beatles, and John Coltrane, and then, you know, it was a mixture of all different styles, but that's gone now. You know, now it's all formatted. It's all corporate. You know, the radio stations, the AM radio stations are all corporate. And then FM radio, you know, like I listen to 88.5, which is the jazz station. Mm-hmm. I listen to some
jazz
alternative station in the Valley that plays the modern rock music, which I really like. I forget what it's called, station, but 87.5, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if, I don't think we can go back, you know. I think it's moving forward to something that I can't explain and I can't define. I don't know where it's going, but I'm just kind of watching it. And, you know, all I care about is writing another song. Maybe I go out to the valley, I record with my friend Jeff Pacetto, and I put out six or seven self-produced, that Jeff produced CDs that are sitting in my kitchen. I can't sell them. I can't give them away. No, I've tried to give CDs to people. They look at me like, what's a CD?
You have to stream it. You have to go on Bandcamp and stream it.
Even for me doing this is a stretch, you know, because I'm so not a computer guy, you know.
This is pretty easy, though.
And this is easy. I'm not as bad as some people, but I'm not really good with the technology, you know.
Yeah, I actually love technology. I think it's fascinating. It's another tool to use.
Here I am.
That's right. Look at you making technology history. Got you on the show. You hit the link. You did everything you're supposed to do. I'm impressed.
Thank you. Tell Terry that.
No, when you said you were a step above him, I did tell him that yesterday. I talked to him. He started laughing. I was like, yeah, he said he was a step above you.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can send it. Terry doesn't do emails or
you know. No, he does not.
And I can do emails. I can send MP3s to people.
You have a cell phone.
I have a cell phone. I do social media. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Facebook.
That's right.
I post songs on Facebook. You know, I mean, but that's about it. Mm-hmm. If I have a problem with my computer, I freak out.
Mm-hmm. Well, you'll be fine.
I'm all right.
They won't leave you. They give you enough time to learn AI now. They've given classes to people.
The whole AI thing with the songwriting thing really bothers me.
Why?
Because I've spent 60 years of my life perfecting my craft, trying to figure out how to write songs, writing 100 songs that were garbage before I wrote one really good song. And I've spent my time honing that craft. Now AI comes along. Someone can come in there with no musical ability, no talent, no nothing, and feed some prompts into Suno or whatever this crazy thing is. 3 minutes later, they've got a song.
With the melody and the lyrics.
And it's like, you know, I mean, I'm sure there's ways to use AI and Suno, but for me, it's like, I don't know. There's no heartbeat. There's no DNA. There's no. It's not a human thing. You know, it's like a machine made this song. I don't know. Call me old fashioned, but Bob Dylan wouldn't like AI. He wouldn't. Neil Young is not going to be using AI to write a song. You know, Neil Diamond isn't going to be.
Well, I look at it as a way that's it can stimulate your writing.
It can
stimulate your creativity. Because I've asked it questions, and when it came back, it made me think like, oh, wow, I didn't think about it like that or whatever.
You know, I'm sure there's positives to it. I'm not going to be a grumpy old man and say it's useless. You know, I'm just saying for my own particular, I saw this thing, you know, like I said, just like cell phones made everybody a photographer, Suno is making everybody a musician. Oh, come on.
I know,
you're either a musician or you're not. You either have music and ability, you either can play an instrument or sing or write a song, or you can't, you know?
But superficially, at the end of the day, when everything is shut off and someone is sitting in a studio with their pencil in their hand or their pen in their hand ready to write and sing, you can't capture it through AI. I mean, even if you use AI,
right,
there's still a part of the human being that's going to express itself because we're human. We have to.
Right, and that's where the DNA and the heartbeat and the soul come into it, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that AI is a bad thing, and I'm sure some people can use it to inspire them and to, like you say, trigger something that they didn't think of before. And God bless them, you know? Who am I to judge? But I just, for me, I'm not drawn to that.
Yeah.
I still want to write a song, you know, play a couple of chords and come up with a song. Good, bad, or otherwise. It's what I like to do.
And thank goodness you can still do that.
And I do it. I love to do it. You know, it's still yeah. what gets me off, you know.
So you like the process. You like the whole process of.
Yeah, like, you know, AI is just about the result.
Yeah,
I like the process of writing a song, mm-hmm. what I go through, you know, honing the words, changing a the to an ah, you know, whatever it is that I do in editing myself and my songs, you know, I enjoy that. And like I said, you know, I'm not going to put it, people who use AI down, but it's not for me.
Yeah, my feeling is that there'll be younger people that will come along and see a song by Marty Balin or a song by Jesse Barish and pick it up. Because a lot of them, believe it or not, because I love young people, I like the way their minds sink, and I like to encourage and influence them as they influence me as well. But somebody's going to pick up those songs, and some 20-year-old is going to make a whole platform that all they do is play old rock and old this and that, and that's going to make it popular. Because a lot of them, believe it or not, a lot of them listen to old rock and stuff. Everybody doesn't listen to what's on the radio. That's what I thought. Until I start going out to different events and things like that, I'm like, there was some kid walking up the street the other day when I was walking my dog. And he was humming. I'm like, what are you listening to? He said some old classic rock. And it was a Who or something. He had to be like 19 years old.
Right. Well, like you said, people are going to rediscover that again, you know?
So it is being rediscovered. So before we go, we're getting close to the end of our time, so you don't have to worry about being on the online too much longer or doing the internet.
I'm having a good time, Osiris. It's been great.
Thank you. Where can we find more about you? I know you have jessebarish.com.
On SoundCloud. I have about 30 or 40 songs on SoundCloud.
Oh, okay.
And songs that I've done in the last few years. So if you want to hear what I've been up to, you can go to SoundCloud.
I would love that. Yeah.
And there's a bunch of songs, and you know, that's what I've been up to.
So we can find you on jessebarish.com. We can find you on Instagram under Jesse Barish.
On Instagram, Barish Jesse.
It's backwards. Barish is B-A-R-I-S-H. Jesse is J-E-S-S-E. The cool
one comment. Word. Yeah, Barish Jesse on Instagram. Okay. Jesse Barish on Facebook. And
jessebarish.com on the internet.
Yeah, Jesse Barish Music is jessebarish.com. Same thing.
Wow. And then what can we expect for you? What are you thinking about putting anything out? Just taking it over somewhere?
You know, I just started a new song. I just started recording a new song yesterday out in Encino with my friend Jeff Bassetto, who I've been working with for 35 years. Wonderful, talented, brilliant, genius guy.
I know Jeff.
Yeah, incredible singer. And we have our little formula for working, you know, just the two of us. And we make great music together. So I just wrote a new song called Strange Days. And we started it yesterday. Even though
that's a nice song title, because there's a movie called Strange Days too.
And there's a Doors album called Strange Days. So it just came out that, you know, and they have a song called Strange Days, but you can have many songs called Strange Days. You can't copyright a title.
But the good thing is that it's it's something that people can feel, they can feel it in their mind because it's already familiar, the phrase.
And these are strange days.
Very strange. Stranger than I've ever seen.
Me too.
Everybody, we're going to close out the show. It's getting time, you know, that we got to run and get up out of here. I want to say thank you again to our amazing, legendary guest, songwriter, musician, performer, and all-around cool-ass guy, Jesse Barish. You can reach out to him if you want, for you young people out there, you young kids. I saw a kid on American Idol a few weeks ago. I think he was like 9 years old. And he came out and blew everybody away. He was playing the guitar, like a rock guitar. And I think Simon said, who's your influence? I mean, he got a standing
ovation. Was this America's Got Talent?
America's Got Talent. Yeah, that little boy was bad.
I saw that kid.
My gosh. I'm like, oh, he's got a career. They're going to take him.
Yeah, you know, that's what the industry's looking for, 9-year-olds.
Yeah, but he had it though. You could tell that he went and listened to the old guys, yeah, you know, the old classic things.
It's going to come back. I think what goes around comes around. I think it's going to come back around.
Cycle.
People are going to get so sick of AI and technology that they're going to go back to four guys and two guitars, bass and drums, and want to hear real music.
That's right. They're doing it now. As a matter of fact, people are doing it now. You'd be surprised how many young people, like I said, that kid that was walking up the street rocking to old The Who. I'm like, oh, wow.
That's who we want. That kid bopping to The Who.
Yeah, he was bopping to The Who. But anyway, I am so happy that all of you joined us today and our guest.
Thank you
again,
for having
Jesse Garish.
I'm so happy you came. And we finally meet. It's been
thanks
wonderful.
For, I know, after all these years.
Thank you.
I like you. I like you because you're good people out there. We have a luminary sitting in front of us. Luminaries are people of light. People that choose love over chaos. People that choose peace and harmony over conflict and disharmony. That's what I call my luminaries and my looms. And we definitely have one of them on the show. Don't forget that I like you because you can look at yourself every day and tell the truth and look honestly and say, did you screw up today, Osiris? Or did you do a good job when you were able to interact with people? You know, thank you for being able to do that. And let me give a shout out to Sam Hassan with LA Talk Radio, who has stuck by me through some tremendous odds and has always been encouraging to me to keep the show going, despite sometimes I wanted to give up. He really pushed me to keep everything going and told me that I would do a great job. And I'm so happy that he did that. I don't know how I could do the show without him. Thank you so much, Sam. And then all of you out there, I cannot be on air without numbers. You know what kind of time we're in now. They don't care if you're talented, if you're beautiful or gorgeous. They want to see the numbers along with the rest of that. So please like, share, and subscribe what you see, what you hear. And you can talk to me at any time. I'm very easy to talk to. Ask anybody. You may not be able to shut me up once I get going. But you'll have fun, definitely. And then hit me up on IG, Osiris_Munir_the painter. And just hit me up in general. Just Google Osiris Munir. I'm all over the place, everywhere at the same time, all over the place. And don't forget, we'll see you back next week. We're going to thank once again our talented, legendary guest, Jesse Barish of Jefferson Starship, Jefferson Airboat, whatever one you want to call it. And Marty Ballin is out there somewhere saying, yo, 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 Jess.
There you go.
That's the way to do it. And we'll see you next week, same time, same place. Same
okay, Osiris. Take care.
Love you. Bye.
Peace and love.
You're listening to The Osiris Munir Show, only on LA Talk Radio.